I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Brian Antonsen joins me again. The author, broadcaster, and retired educator is in the chat. I had a lot of fun talking on and off the air with Brian when he and his brother Rick last December when they came in for their bestseller written with Mary Trainor, Whistle Post West, Railway Tales from British Columbia, Alberta, and Yukon was published. Brian joins me now to discuss anything and everything. We'll talk about the previous book they did, Slumax Gold in Search of a Legend. It's a book that sold thousands of copies when it was first published in the early 1970s and again when reissued by Heritage House in 2007. You can still get it, and it's a hell of a read. I read it around the spring, and it's got everything. Gold, murder, mystery, crime.
Yeah, it's all there.
Yeah. I'll get Brian to tell us about how they came about writing this over 40 years ago and what they've uncovered since. I'll also ask Mr. Antonsen about broadcasting. He's a graduate of the British Columbia Institute of Technology, going on from there to a career at CKNW as production director, then returning to BCIT as an instructor, culminating in being associate dean of broadcast and media of the Broadcast and Media Communications Department upon his early retirement in 2010. Since then, he's written and traveled extensively. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Brian Antonsen. Mr. Antonsen, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks, Brian, Mister, that's our father, right?
I don't know. No one's ever asked me that, and I'm kind of hurt. Why I do that? Please welcome to the Plant Online program. Yada yada. Good morning, Mister or Ms.
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
I stole that from Imus.
Doc Imus. Yeah.
And for 40, almost 50 years now that he's been in broadcasting, he does that.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things, I guess, because I never went to BCIT, and like you, and nearly everybody that I listen to or watch on TV in this market, you just pick things from different people. So there's certain things that I steal from Dick Cavett, certain things I steal from Rafe and
these
Webster.
Are not bad people to steal from.
Yeah, so you just have to learn how to steal, I guess. You know what I mean? That's a Jack Cullen phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So we'll talk about some of these folks that you worked with over the years, but one of the reasons why you're here is because I want to talk to you about Slumax Gold. Because it's such a good book, and as Ellen Twigg says, it's a British Columbia classic. It was first published 72, was it?
1972.
And you, Rick, and Mary, you were just kids, literally, right?
We were. I would have been, Mary and I are the same age, Rick is a year younger, so I would have been, 24?
And I guess, other than who Slumac was and this gold and the story, I mean, how did you guys come to write about this at such a young age?
Well, we got kind of caught by the whole story when I would have been 9, and brother Rick would have been 8, and we're sitting around a campfire, and we were listening to ghost stories told by a woman who was probably older than me now. And she was enthralling all these little kids. There must have been 10 of us sitting around the campfire. One of them was the Slumax Gold story. She didn't call it Slumax Gold. She told us about this lost gold mine up behind Pitt Lake, and there was a curse on it, and gave us the rough legend. Well, we then, several of us said, well, when we grow up, we're going to go and find that mine. And, of course, as we grew up, logic and sense prevailed, and we realized it's pretty rough country up there. Rick was working with Mary. I had known Mary, she was a year behind me at BCIT in the broadcast program as students. And so the three of us were young marrieds, and we sat down as couples, and we got talking about maybe doing something about that legend. And that led us to kind of explore the story more. We learned a lot from a guy named Alan Jay, who was a reporter at the Columbian, and they covered this 8 Ways from Tuesday, being the New Westminster newspaper. And there was Burnaby coverage and lots of province and Vancouver Sun coverage and so on. So we decided, yes, we could make a book out of this. It would be a self-published type thing. And so in 1971, we started working on it. I spent some time in the archives in Victoria digging out the judge's bench book from 1890, the fall of 1890. Read every word and found no mention whatsoever of lost women or lost gold or curses or anything. But anyway, we got this massive material together, and we started to write the book. And we published it in the spring of 1972, and over 3 different editions, it sold 10,000 copies.
Wow.
Not bad.
Yeah.
I think the first edition, was maybe $1.85 or something like that for the sale price. I've seen it online, if you can get it, for around $40 these days.
I've seen it at like the big book chain up to maybe just under a year ago. Like on
one of the original ones?
No, with the
Heritage
House edition, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so you still can get it, and you can certainly get it online, yeah.
Yeah. This one is available. We were at a Chapters event a couple of Saturdays ago, and they sold 25 of our books, I think, but most of them were Slumax, so probably, you know, 15 Slumax went out the door.
Yeah, and it's such a compelling story, because even after 45 years or so, you still really don't know what happened.
No,
and so the name the Slumac. I mean, who was he?
Slumac was a Catesy fellow, probably about 80 at the time. So the images.
Maybe the turn of the century.
This would have been 1890 when he actually was involved in the murder for which he was. Ultimately hanged. So he would have been, by most reports, about 80 at the time. And he was a local guy who lived on the west side of the Pitt River. There's a lot of development right now in that area, but it's at the foot of Burke Mountain in Coquitlam. And he had a cabin on the shore there. And so he hunted and did various different things there. He was a known character at the time. People knew of him. And he had a long-standing feud with a guy named Louis B. And one day, both were out hunting. They both came at, there are differing reports, was it at the Alouette Slough, where the Alouette River joined the Pitt from the east, or was it on the other side? Nobody knows for sure, but in any case, they exchanged words, and apparently, according to the witness, Louis B. raised his tomahawk, and Slumac raised his rifle and shot him, and he died. And Slumac fled into the bush, and they hunted for him for a couple of months, finally flushed him out in late November, put him on trial in December. It was a three-hour trial, a 15-minute jury sequestering, and he was convicted. Mm. Now, that wouldn't happen today. Today, it would probably be a case of self-defense or, at the very least, very most manslaughter. But no, Slumac ended up being sentenced to hang, and he did on January the 16th of 1891.
And so the gold and just was it his gold and you know, how much was there? And I mean, these are questions that you still really don't know, right?
Nobody knows. Nobody knows the attachment of Slumac's name to the legend of the lost gold mine. There's gold up there, and people know that. And of course, there's the Fraser River gold rush and all of those different things. But Slumac probably never had any gold, or if he did, it was in very, very small quantities. But somehow, in the intervening 10 years, up to 1901, his name became associated somehow with some lost gold. And a guy, this is legendary, but nonetheless there was something circulating at that time, that there was lost gold up in that area. A guy named John Jackson supposedly arrived in New Westminster. And Jackson heard the legend. He was coming back from the Alaskan goldfields, Klondike and so on. He heard about this. He lit off into the bush and came back a few months later, and he was a broken man. His health was gone. But according to the legend, he had a pack sack full of gold. Mm. And he took that with him back to San Francisco. And then he died in 1904. But he had deposited something like $8,000 worth of gold in the Bank of British North America, which was in those days a different name for what we know today as the Bank of Montreal. Mm. The 1906 earthquake wiped out the bank records and so on. They were all burned. So despite searches, nobody's ever confirmed that he actually existed or that he deposited any money in San Francisco. But that had things rolling, and people have been looking since then for this lost gold mine. We know that Slumac's name was associated with it because of a newspaper item from a Wisconsin go figure, Wisconsin newspaper in 1915, where a local prospector was heading to British Columbia to look for the famous Slumock Lost Gold Mine, S-L-U-M-M-O-C-K. And, of course, our perceived selling is, spelling is S-L-U-M-A-C-H. But Slumock, Slumack, it's the same guy. And so we know that as far back as 1915, somebody was going looking for his lost gold mine.
And a lot of people since have gone. And
thousands.
And a lot of people, a number of people have also died and injured, right?
There are words that, excuse me, back in 1963, there was a fellow named Louis Hagbo who died. They found his body. And they called him the 23rd victim of the mine, or of the curse. How many since? I don't know. There are people up there all the time who get lost, who get rescued these days, who are never heard from again or whatever, you know. So we don't know what the actual number would be. But yes, there are a number of people. Probably the most famous of all is a guy named Volcanic Brown. And Volcanic Brown, Doc Brown to some, was a famous prospector, and he discovered a lot of mines across British Columbia. Copper Mountain up by Princeton, the big slag heap that you see as you're driving on the Hope Princeton Highway, that's one of his most famous finds. And, of course, where copper is, you'll usually find silver and gold in some quantity and so on. So Volcanic Brown came in the late 1920s, came to town, and he set out to look for the mine. Mm-hmm. 1 year, he did not come back. So a search party went in looking for him. They found him, frostbitten toes. He'd cut a couple of them off and so on. There's a picture of him with a bandage around his foot. So that may be an accurate portrayal of him. So Volcanic recuperated, went back in the next year, did not come out. They searched for him, and they never found him. Now, the legend on that side of things is that they found his last camp. And apparently, according, again, and this is all legendary, and you got to separate the legend from the fact that somebody did actually live and did hang for Louis B.'s murder and so on. The legend of Volcanic Brown says that they found a glass jar in his tent with 11 ounces of raw gold in it. What does that prove? He found it nearby. He took it in with him. It was a false flag type operation where he left it there, meanwhile took off with the bullion and headed south. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But he would be the most famous loss of a person looking for Slumack's mine.
And in this 2007 edition of the book, which people can still get, you spend some time near the back of the book talking about all these people.
Yes.
That and that's new stuff in the new edition of the book,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, the original version was 56 pages long. This is 160. And it contains some of the old material, but it's much broader than that. And we spend a lot of time talking about famous gold seekers, mm-hmm. or maybe not famous, but gold seekers, people who have some fame in the Slumack story, mm-hmm. Who have been seeking that gold. Most credible of all is another Brown, no relation, but to me, and I wrote that particular tale, the story of a guy named Stu Brown. And Stu Brown worked, he was a qualified guy, he had a degree, worked for the forestry department, so he was a government employee, and he claimed to have been up in the, what we believe is the Sloquet Creek Valley, and there's a lot of feeder streams that go into that, southeast corner of Garibaldi or Golden Ears Park in that area. So he was within a provincial park, and he was doing his forestry work and walking through a stream, ankle deep in water, looked down and realized it was glistening. And so he reached down and came up with the proverbial handful of gold nuggets the size of walnuts. And this is what Slumack supposedly had thrown around the saloons. If somebody was throwing gold nuggets in the late 1890s, or late 1880s, around saloons in Westminster, that would have made front page news. And there's nothing in the newspapers of the day to mention that. But Stu Brown claimed that he'd found these nuggets, went to the provincial government, said, "Guess what I found?" And they said, he claimed you could pay off the provincial debt with this. They apparently said, well, you can't mine in a provincial park. He said, you don't mine. All you do is stick your hand in the water and come up with nuggets.
Yeah.
And that never went anywhere. And there's so much material, the volumes of material that he wrote to the government trying to convince them to go in there. And he died a long-retired, elderly, bitter man because nobody had paid attention to his find.
Did you, Rick, or Mary, find any gold yourself over
no.
the years?
No.
Did you try?
A little bit.
Yeah.
I've been up the... Rick's done some canoeing and a little bit of exploring up the lake. I have been up the Widgeon Creek area, which is one of the supposed sites of it. We put down claims. We were involved in the television series Curse of the Frozen Gold. And so talking with another one of the many searchers, we decided to put down a couple of claims in the Canyon Creek Valley, so we've been able to, you know, have some claims to some, what's a gold claim, I don't know, a few acres in size,
mm-hmm.
But it's treacherous country. Daryl, the fellow who we got this information from, he, on the television show, he's going down, rappelling down 200 feet of cliff. And that's dangerous work.
Yeah. You know?
So it is dangerous territory, very steep, prone to landslides, lots of rain, terrible weather up there, actually.
Yeah.
And if you go up high, you're into glacier territory. So it's not really hospitable. If the series is renewed for a second season, we were on one of the six shows. If it's renewed, we may actually get into the Sloquet Valley.
Yeah.
They said, well, we should take you guys
into
the Sloquet. But if thousands of people have been up there searching for it over the years, what are the chances that Rick and I are going to find it?
Yeah.
You know, in a 1 or 2 day trip up there. Not huge. But I believe that is the most credible of all the reports, the Sloquet Valley.
Yeah. Well, that may be the subject of another edition of this book. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were talking about should we update it for the, one of the anniversaries
right.
that are coming. It would be exciting to do that, but we do have to have new material. Since this book came out, somebody's found his actual grave. He was buried in an unmarked grave in Sapperton, and we actually, there were several of us who stood at that gravesite on January the 16th of 2011, so like 120 years down from the day that he was hanged, and we stood at his gravesite and we laid cedar boughs on it, kind of a gesture.
Yeah.
But it remains unmarked. Not very many people know where it is, and there's other little elements that have come in, but we have to have something really, a grabber, I suppose.
Yeah.
And yeah, finding gold.
Yeah.
Not necessarily finding the hoard, but finding a significant gold up there would be a grabber.
And the last book that you, Rick, and Mary had, Whistle Post West, I mean, we talked about that in December, just after that came out. That was a huge hit, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's done well, sold over 2,000. Now, Slumax Gold has sold over 11,000, but it's been out since 2007. The Whistle Post West has had a really good initial success, and several people, including the publisher, have said, ultimately, this will do better than Slumax. We'll see.
Yeah.
But it's off, with the first, 7, 8 months or something like that, over 2,000 sales.
Yeah.
So we're really pleased with that.
This reverence, this appreciation for history that you have, where does that come from?
Well, I think all three of us have been interested in history, but all three of us had a particular interest in British Columbia history because it's fascinating. There's a lot of it out there. You know, we don't have the shoot 'em up stuff from American history,
mm-hmm.
but you know, when you look at the railroads, when you look at what it took to build the railroads, when you look at the Gold Rush history, when you look at the towns that were founded and that are now in ghost town shape, all of those things are fascinating. They're grabbers. Brother Rick and Brother Greg, our kid brother, And I went up to Kelowna in May to visit our uncle, who's the last surviving member of his generation, and he was turning 95. On the way home, we came down through the Aspen Grove route down toward Princeton, and we stopped at the site of Granite City. Now, it's a ghost town. There's one cabin that's almost still standing, and beyond that, it's gone. But at one time, Granite City was the largest city north of San Francisco or west of Chicago. Hmm. There were 5,000 people there and 14 saloons, and now it's just a great big, I don't know how many acres in size, 5 acres or something like that. But it's mostly just, you know, rock and brush and maybe a couple of rattlesnakes. But it's fascinating to think that there was a community there of 5,000 people. And one of the things that keeps people going back to Granite City is that there's the legend of Johnny Chance. Johnny Chance was a miner, a prospector. And they took gazillions of dollars out of Granite Creek. It was a valid place. Mm-hmm. And lots of people got rich in Granite City. But there was a white metal that they couldn't quite figure out that they kept tossing away and giving to the kids to play and so on. Johnny Chance thought, he said that there's got to be something to that. So he kept a bucket full of this white metal. He was leaving town, intending to return, so he buried it a certain number of paces from his front door toward the old oak tree. He came back, and his cabin had burned down. The oak tree had been cut down. There was no evidence of where he used to be. And he then searched for that, and he's been gone for a long time. But other people have been searching for his bucket because it proved to be platinum. Mm. So as well as gold, there was platinum in Granite Creek. And so that legend has kept people going back to Granite Creek. And so those compelling stories, to me, they're intriguing. The expansion of the coast. How did we... Who was here first? Was it Captain Cook? Was it Captain Vancouver? Or was it the Spanish? Or was it even Polynesians? You know, the Kanaka Creek in Haney, in the Maple Ridge area, named after the Kanaka people who supposedly came from Hawaii. Mm. So who was first? Was it people who came over the Bering Land Bridge and came down 15, 20,000 years ago as the Ice Age was starting to retreat? Or, who knows who was first here. And there's the legend of Spanish Mound about the Spanish who may have come up in through the Carameas area and who had a battle and ended up being conquered and buried in a mound. Well, imagine what that would be like to find today. A mound of Spanish soldiers, all their armor, all their weaponry, all their horses, all the cooking supplies. Imagine what kind of an archaeological find that would be. So I find those things compelling, and Mary, who grew up in Summerland, and actually I think she, I guess we should confirm this, but I think she was taught at one point in time by Bill Barley, who of course was such a wonderful chronicler of BC history, and that kind of got us all interested, his Canada West magazine and so on. And Rick, you know, the three of us had a common interest then, and we said, let's go.
Yeah, I guess what's rooted in all of this is just the geography of the place, because you've traveled this province, and I mean, it's just fascinating to think about the history and how much of this land is tied into how we view British Columbia.
Yes, and how much land there is.
Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely huge. The whole of the British Isles would fit into, even with Brexit, as they break away from Europe, the whole of the British Isles would fit into British Columbia and then some.
Dramatically going from Slumach's gold and history, one of the reasons why we're here today, I want to ask you about broadcasting, because you've spent 43 years at BCIT?
No, 33 years at BCIT, a decade at CKNW. So, yeah, since 1967, I've been a paid employee in something to do with the broadcast business and loved virtually every moment of it.
Yeah, and from what I've read of you and what we've talked over the last little while, I mean, growing up for you, there was a great love and reverence for radio.
Yeah. I have a very early memory of singing to the radio, hoping that it was a two-way thing, so they could hear how great a singer I was. I must have been six.
Yeah.
And so I would be singing, hoping that they would say, why don't you come in and sing on the radio?
Yeah.
So I really liked radio from earliest days. And I've liked music. I've been a fan of music from the early 50s when I first became aware of it as a child. And I got an early rocket radio, the kind that you used alligator clips to, you know, tie to the house heating system, which gave you the mass to act as an antenna. And matter of fact, my favorite song ever, and Rick's, it turns out, we both had rocket radios, and our favorite song is May You Always by the McGuire Sisters, a moderate hit for them from 1959. Why would that be? Well, we used to be up late listening to the radio when we were supposed to be asleep, but we had our earplugs in, and we were listening to Jerry Davies, the all-night radio man, all-night record man, it was his show was called, on CKNW, and he would always play May You Always when it was a big hit. So that's been, you know, a favorite song forever.
Yeah.
And early 60s, my dad brought home from work an amplifier and a speaker and a small 45 record player. It was an RCA 45, literally the size of a 45 record, and some records and a microphone. And he said, this is what disc jockeys use to go on the radio. So I hooked all this stuff up, and I was able to lean into the microphone and say, it's 10 minutes past 10 o'clock, and this is Brian Antonsen on the radio. And I was stumbling along, but I was doing it.
Yeah.
And from that time, I think that was about 1962, I was gone. I was hooked.
And so you went to BCIT.
Yep.
And I guess that just after it opened, right?
3 years. I was in the BCIT opened its doors in 1964. And I was doing some hobby radio at the time at home, and we actually had our hobby station in the PNE's hobby show and won best in show awards and so on. And then when I went to SFU as a brand new graduate of high school, I was involved in starting the campus radio station, which is still on the air today.
CJSF.
And so I'm dad to CJSF, along with a fellow named John Bishop and Rob Turner. And the three of us were standing on the academic quadrangle steps one day, and I was telling them about my dream of starting a campus radio station. And Rob said, and I'd gone to high school with Rob and John.
Yeah.
And Rob said, so are we going to talk about it, or are we going to do it? And we said, let's do it. So we got a group together and started the station. But BCIT was establishing itself as a its reputation, and I knew that that was my route to get into broadcasting. So I enrolled in 1967, graduated in 69, started working at CKNW part-time in my first term, and the rest is history.
So you were production director at NW.
Ultimately, right? Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
What did that involve?
Well, CKNW had a guy named Dick Abbott was production director, and Dick actually hired me, Dick and Hal Davis, and Dick is revered as perhaps Vancouver's best producer, best audio radio producer, and he was just fabulous, and what a mentor, what a guide, what a creative person. Long retired now, but Dick was just tops in everybody's mind, and so he hired me into the department. And when the radio station was expanding, and we created a company called Western Productions, which would do agency production work and so on, Dick left to run Western Productions, and I took over as production director in 1974 when he left. And so the department had three people full-time. It had, we eventually had a fourth person come in the evenings because there was just so much work to do. We continued to do agency work because Dick just couldn't handle it all at Western Productions, so people would still come out to New Westminster to do some agency work. And I loved that. We, you know, we did music recording. We did worked with some of the top talent in Vancouver. Just fabulous, creative people. And And then we had a bunch of part-time people who also fell under our department, the operators and so on, which is what I'd started as, a BCIT student and an operator. So I loved that work. And then BCIT called and said, would you come here? And it was a really tough decision to leave what I loved to go to something that I thought I loved. I was teaching night school at the time, and I really enjoyed that. But did I want to do that for the rest of my life or even for 5 years? But I took the plunge, and it was the best career move I have ever made. Loved it.
And we'll reflect on your years at BCIT in a moment. But just those years at NW, so this would have been in the 70s.
Yeah, late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
Or through until the late 70s.
So what's it like for you? Because, I mean, that station has had such a part in a lot of our lives in this part of the world. For you, growing up, listening to it, and then being there with all the people that you listened to growing up.
A dream come true.
Yeah.
You know, I used to listen to Bob Hutton in the morning. Well, all of a sudden, there's Bob Hutton, and he called me the kid. And he'd say, hey, kid, how are you doing, the kid? And then one day he said to me, you know, for the longest time, I thought you were Irish. And I said, Irish? Why? And he said, well, when you walk down the hall, people would say, O'Brien. This is Hutton humor, you know. And so Bob was one of a kind, and he did wonderful work. And Frosty was in the afternoons. Jack Kyle was doing middays and so on. Cullen in the evenings, Webster, Dave Abbott, Al Davidson, you know, all these huge names from Vancouver broadcast history. And then when Bob retired, then Frosty moved into the mornings.
Yeah.
And I think he did 30 years of number one radio work and carrying on where Hutton had been, you know. And so just... it's in my DNA, I guess, to be part of the CKNW thing, even though it's a much different station today, and it's many, many miles down the road. NW, and they've had some ratings challenges, but they're moving back up now, and they've been a market dominator forever.
The medium of radio, because it's such a part of our lives in this part of the world over the years. Do you think it can be relevant still?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm a radio believer. And when I was getting into the business in 1967, I was taking the broadcasting course at BCIT, and people were saying, why would you be going into a dying medium? Mm. 1967, you know, that's like 50 years ago now. And people were saying to me, why are you going into a dying medium? And radio is still very much alive, still very much relevant. It routinely, and here we have the internet age, we have all sorts of different sources of information today, but AM and FM radio and television, the traditional forms of broadcasting, if you will, are still dominant in around the lives of 9 out of 10 of all people every day. So they consistently, you know, it goes up and down, but you look at the numbers from the people who track these things, mm-hmm. and they're talking 89%, 92% of people are listening to the radio every day. Where do those numbers come from? From very qualified sources who do a lot of polling and so on, from radio ratings and whatnot. So these are, it's not just a gut feel, you know. People have been saying to me for 25 years now, I got a feeling that radio is going to die and it's going to go over to this new thing called the internet. Not quite 25, but about 22, 23 years. Mm-hmm. Well, there's lots of internet listening today and internet marketing and so on, but radio continues to be very viable. It continues to be cost effective to get your message out. Read something last week about radio's reach and television's reach. And a lot of the big advertisers who used to be on traditional media, radio and television, moved over to digital media, but they weren't getting the results that they used to get. So now they've moved back, and their buys, they won't have abandoned digital, but their buys will have gone back to traditional media, and their numbers are going up again. So I think for the long term, and it may be different when the boomers are all gone or something, you know, several decades down the road, who knows, the way things might change. But radio right now and for a long time to come yet is a very viable medium.
You spent a majority of your career teaching at BCIT, and there's this Greg Douglas column upon your retirement in 2010.
Yeah.
And just the names of the people that went through BCIT.
Oh,
I mean, as I said earlier, I mean, everyone we listen to or watch on television goes through BCIT.
Not everyone, but certainly
literally,
in this market,
it seems
a
like,
lot.
Yeah.
Well, as a matter of fact, there were a couple of people from the CRTC who were out here, and I met with them. I got to know a number of people in the commission, mm-hmm. and I met with them and showed them our facility, talked to them about things. And then a couple of days later, I was at a cocktail party, and one of them said, so virtually everyone that we've met in our tour of Vancouver and Victoria radio stations went to school at BCIT, and they know you. And I said, well, not all, virtually everyone that we met.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of story I've heard. It's anecdotal, of course, but that's the kind of story I've heard over the years. Many, many people in many radio stations and television operations and so on got their start with us. And, of course, that spread into the audio and video recording production houses, into film. A lot of the people in the film business are BCIT grads. So it has there have been, I don't know, way in excess of 4,000 now grads go through those doors. So there's a lot of people out there.
Must be awfully rewarding as an educator to
It is.
Realize that.
It's really neat to see somebody in their first night at night school and recall that moment when you looked at them in that very first class in night school when they were wondering if this should be a career. And many people I can say I looked at in that first night or the first couple of nights and thought, you're going somewhere.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they have.
Well, what is it that you see in someone that you think will make it?
Fire in their eyes. Yeah. I was telling somebody the other day, somebody asked a similar question about that. And I told them about one fella who did an awfully good career. He's just now retired. But he had a really good career in radio and then in television in the background. He was a writer, he was a producer, he was all these things. We do in the radio intro night school course that I still teach, we do simulations. So everybody takes a role, and the leader is the program director, just like any radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this guy in one of my very early classes, and he wore bib overalls at the time. It was kind of a stylish thing. And I remember a question coming up, and somebody was kidding around about it, somebody else in the class. And this guy kind of shrugged his shoulders, and he grimaced, and he kind of, I could see this look on his face. He was serious about what they were doing, and other people weren't taking it seriously. I predicted success for him right away. And I followed his career, and we see each other frequently. He went all the way through a very good senior career with that same kind of mental attitude. So when you see the lights go on, when you see the fire in their eyes, when you see the desire to go somewhere, you know that person's going to be a success.
And I'm sure people must think about journalism and broadcasting today as not having a future, perhaps. And, and so what do you tell people who may be thinking of it as a career, and what do you tell them in terms of what they need to succeed?
I tell them about my experience 40, 50 years ago, being told that there was no future in it. It was a dying industry. It's a different industry. I think you have to be very honest with people. It's much harder because it's telescoped in size in terms of ownership and all of that sort of thing. So you have to be real and you have to be honest with people. But I talk about work ethic. A fellow that I worked with many, many years ago said to me, they pay you from 8:30 to 5, so don't give them any time before or after. Wrong.
Mm.
I gave lots of time early in the mornings. I gave lots of times evenings and weekends, and ended up as production director at CKN. Ended up as associate dean running the department at BCIT for a quarter century. So if you're willing to be dedicated to go that extra mile, to learn as much as you can. You know, one of the things that I say at my very first night of night school with people is you've got to develop a broad general knowledge. You have to know a little bit about many things, jack of all trades and all of that. Just learn as much as you can, even things that don't interest you. Learn enough to interview somebody on those things. As you know, from your side of the microphone, your guest is the person who does most of the talking. That's the way an interview should work. But you have to have some idea of what they're about, what their field is or whatever, before you can get them rolling and then press their button and let them talk. And so any interviewer has to have, any broadcaster has to have that kind of knowledge, general knowledge.
As someone who was an educator for many years in terms of running the department,
yep.
We hear this a lot in terms of, well, not necessarily nursing, but certainly lawyers and that programs like this are graduating too many people,
yep,
to too few jobs. Do you think that that's the case with in terms of broadcasting?
I don't know the exact answer to that question. I think it's time for another sectoral study. Federal government did a sectoral study in 1992, which is way out of date now. I was part of that study. They had a fellow who talked to people all across the country. There are many other schools besides BCIT.
Mm-hmm.
And so he talked to people all the way across the country. He found out how many graduates were coming out of the programs. And I believe at the time it would total around 1,700 every year. And he found out that there were about 2,500 jobs, because people move on to other things, they move up and so on, so there's always entry-level opportunity. I don't know what that number would be today, so it's long overdue for another sectoral study, but there are job offers at all levels on the broadcast job websites. Milkmanunlimited.com is one of them, and I get their information every day. Hardly a day goes by when there's not a number of job opportunities. Might be a senior sales opportunity, but when somebody moves into that, somebody else comes in at the bottom, and so on. We have a situation now where, you know, I'm a third year, I was born in 1948. So the boomer generation started coming to be in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of years later, there was me. I'm 68, and I'm long retired. There's a whole bunch more who were born up to 1964 who are now leaders in many ways in this broadcast business, and they are going to be retiring en masse. So I think that until those people are gone, there's a long road of opportunity for people coming into the industry today. Many of the people that I taught when I was first teaching night school in 1974
mm-hmm.
have retired. Many of them have been broadcast leaders, the current president of the BC Association of Broadcasters, and previous presidents and so on are grads who have done very well. They got to the top of their game in British Columbia broadcasting, and in terms of influence and station management and things like that. So I think that that will continue for the next many years. What happens down the road is anybody's guess. But if prognosticators were saying in 1967 it's a dying business and they were wrong, I have a confidence that they're still wrong today.
There's this, an MLA, I believe, who was one of your students at one point. I saw a photograph on Facebook, I think. He sits in the legislature now and was a student of yours years ago. John Martin.
Oh, John Martin.
Yeah.
John was in my very first class. Yeah. Was talking to John at our broadcast reunion. John's out in Chilliwack, and we had a reunion a year ago,
yeah,
and John attended. And, yeah, John was in the class of 79, sorry, and so he started in 77 when I started as a faculty member,
yeah,
at BCIT. We've had MPs, we've had various different mayors. I was just reading an article the other day about Colin Bassrin, who's the mayor of Kelowna,
yeah,
who is a grad, a broadcast journalism grad, and another fellow was mayor in Prince George. And so, yes, a lot of grads have gone on to the political life and so on.
Are the people that go into broadcasting school wanting to be famous? Are those people that succeed, or are they quickly weeded out, say?
I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to be famous. The broadcast ego can be a problem when you think that you're better than everybody else. Or, you know, I walked into the room and everybody turned to look at me. No, they didn't. Yeah. You go off the air, and you're off the air for about 3 months, and somebody says, didn't you used to be somebody?
Yeah.
You know, so it can change that quickly. So you have to get that ego under control and realize that the sun doesn't rise and set on you. But you have to have a healthy ego also to believe that people might actually want to listen to what you have to say or the reports you might bring or to watch you on television. I think you must want to be, I don't know if famous is the word, but you must have a desire to tell stories. You must have a desire to learn things and then share them with other people and so on. And that brings a lot of people into what ultimately ends up being on air. But there are many viable jobs behind the scenes.
Yeah.
The writers, the people who create the visual work or, you know, do the research or whatever, producers and so on. There's all that, too.
Yeah. And you've since retiring 6 years ago, you've traveled a great deal.
Traveled. I've been very busy. I was asked to be president of the BC Winter Games that came to Mission, where I live, in 2014. And that, for the first couple of years that I was retired, I was working full-time for free and having a ball. And we had a very successful games and brought thousands of athletes and coaches and spectators and so on to Mission for the Winter Games in 2014. And I really, really enjoyed that experience. So added it to my kit bag of things that I've done.
Yeah. And are you continuing to write? I mean,
yes. When we finished Whistle Posts West, Brother Rick was saying, okay, so what's our next project?
Yeah.
And Mary and I were both saying, we'd just like to take a break here, Rick. You know, just got back from Italy a few weeks ago and booked for England. And so we're doing a lot of that stuff. We're fortunate to have health and the ability to do these things. So taking advantage of all of those opportunities now. But I do an awful lot of writing for one thing or another. Always have. It's just I'm blessed with the ability to have it just kind of flow out of my fingers.
Yeah.
I do a lot of editing of what I've written as well. It's not that it's golden prose when it comes out of my fingers.
Isn't that half of writing really editing?
I think so. I self-edit a lot, and then I often will run it past somebody else and say, take a look at this.
Yeah.
And I've learned that from people who I thought were very good writers who have given it to me, their work, and said, I want you to take a look at this, and then have respected my observations. So I thought, okay, if really top people will ask me for my opinion, who am I to say, no, my prose is always golden when it comes out. So I self-edit. I ask other people to look at my material and so on. That's part of the process. Part of the process.
So is there a book that you guys are working on now?
No. But we've got several book ideas.
Yeah.
And maybe a follow-up to Slumax Gold, another anniversary type thing. We don't know. But we've talked to the publisher. Is there any interest in that? We have other stories on the train side of things. So with this success for Whistle Posts West, people are already saying, is there a book number two in the offing? And we know people who have stories to tell. We know that there's maybe 32 stories or something like that. We know that there are more opportunities out there. And so we could find those stories and retell them. And there are other projects that we've talked about, but it's all at the let's sit down, have a glass of wine, and talk stage rather than actually moving forward on anything.
Yeah, Whistle Post West is such a good book.
Yeah,
and it's a book. I think I told you this at the time that you want to read more.
Yeah,
you know you must have had another book of just stuff that you didn't put in this book.
Yeah, there's lots of other stories that we're aware of. And people have come to us with other stories. They've said, I was talking to a guy yesterday at a bit of a do, and he said, you know, my uncle was involved in the railroad, and he's got all sorts of stories. Okay, well, we could talk to him. And not every story would be worthy of being in a book.
Yeah.
But out of 10 stories you hear, 3 might fit, you know.
Yeah.
And so in a province as diverse and as rich in railroad history as ours, there's got to be lots more stories.
It's one of those things that people said that no one's going to be riding trains anymore around this time, and we still are, aren't we?
You bet. I just rode high-speed trains, first real experience with that, in Italy.
Yeah.
And in between major cities, we were doing 300K. That's the fastest I've ever been.
When you're in the thing, does it feel like 300 kilometers?
No,
it's not like a car, I guess, right?
No, it's there's an initial acceleration, but it's relatively gentle. But when you see the little meter say 297, 298, 300K, so you're doing 200 miles an hour, and you look out at the landscape, it's just passing just as if you were driving a car and so on. So there's no real perception. It's like an airplane, right? There's no real perception that you're doing almost 600 miles an hour.
Yeah.
But they are smooth, very smooth. So that's the first experience with real high-speed rail. It's really neat.
Yeah. Well, it's good seeing you again.
Good to be here.
I appreciate you coming in all the way from Mission to do this. And all the best for the summer. Safe travels.
Yeah, and hopefully there will be more travels.
Yeah, indeed.
Thank you.
Slumax Gold in Search of a Legend, you can still get that, and of course Whistle Post West, I always see it on those bestseller lists, and you can get that too. Written with Mary Trainor and Rick Attenson, they're both available from Heritage House. Brian Attenson joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.